Hi, I'm Len Epp from Lean Pub, and in this episode of the Lean Pub podcast, I'll be interviewing Jay LaCroix. Based in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, Jay is a passionate technologist who enjoys working on just about any form of technology he can get his hands on and spends his free time tinkering with network, server, hardware, visualization, Raspberry Pis, writing scripts, and more. With over two decades of experience supporting Linux professionally, Jay started Learn Linux TV, an education company that focuses on teaching concepts that surround Linux and related technologies. As part of this company, Jay writes Linux-related books and produces training content that teaches important concepts from an experienced and hands-on perspective. The YouTube channel of the same name now has over 1 million subscribers and well over 60 million views. So very much congratulations on that, Jay. You can follow him on LinkedIn at Jeremy LaCroix and check out his Learn Linux TV on YouTube channel on YouTube at Learn Linux TV. Jay is the author of the book on LeanPub, Switching to Linux, a practical guide for Windows and Mac users. In the book, Jay guides you step-by-step through your transition to Linux, learning how to find and install software, connect hardware like printers, Bluetooth devices, and external displays, manage your files, enjoy multimedia and gaming, use the command line, and keep your system secure. Each chapter is written for real beginners. No prior Linux experience is required. And by the end, you won't just have Linux running on your computer. You'll have a lot more than that. So in this interview, we're going to talk about Jay's background and career, his book, and at the end, we'll talk a little bit about his experience as a successful writer and video content creator, and hardworking video content creator. So thank you very much, Jay, for being on the Lean Pub podcast.
Absolutely.
I always like to start these interviews by asking people for their origin story. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about where you grew up and how you found yourself interested in, you know, the IT and computers and the career you've built for yourself.
So I grew up in Flint, Michigan, on the lower end of the poverty line, actually. So it was kind of like an incredible journey coming out of that. But back then, I couldn't afford a computer. In fact, I didn't even have a computer until I was 19, believe it or not. So I always wanted one. And I think the fact that, you know, in my household, it wasn't affordable kind of made computers more mythical, right? It's that thing that I can't have makes me want it even more. But to be fair, back then, you know, people not being able to afford a computer, whether you're on the poverty line or not, is not really a factor because computers were so expensive. I remember as a 8 or 9 year old kid, I don't remember why I know this amount, but it was like $1,500 for this computer that I saw at a computer shop. And back then that was a lot more money than it is now. So it wasn't uncommon that people couldn't afford computers or anything, but there was always this struggle with that. And, you know, growing up in Flint, Michigan, having 90th percentile ADHD, which created a learning disability. And then this passion for technology that I had where I just really loved it. I didn't understand why, but I didn't care to explain it. I like what I like. And I always kind of knew that's what I wanted to go into. So almost everybody has this identity crisis in high school. It's like, I'm getting close to the end of high school. What do I want to do with my life? What kind of work do I want to be doing? For me, thankfully, I never really had that question. I always knew. I did try other things and I, you know, just didn't work out too well. So I decided to go into IT, and I remember going to college. I couldn't even afford a car, so I walked 7 miles, you know, one way just to go to college, and I actually worked at the college. So, and while I was at that college, I kept hearing about this Linux thing. I mean, I knew I was interested in it, but I didn't really know much about it. It just seemed kind of cool. I was taking a Unix class, and I thought it was a lot of fun. So I decided I was going to try it out. So I discovered that there's a bunch of distributions. And then I said, nope, not going to bother. That's way too much. I just can't even make sense of all this. So nope, forget it. And then a couple months later in the Unix class, which is still going on, a teacher walks in and he's like, we're doing a pilot for a Linux class. If anyone is interested, I'll leave the sign up sheet here at the front of the room. So I signed up and no one else in the Unix class did. I guess I was the only one in that class that was interested. So I got the book ahead of the class, like a couple months before the class started. I already had the textbook and I read it and I just went cover to cover twice by the time I actually started the class. And I just became absolutely obsessed with it. So by the time the class started, I was helping other people in the class to make sense of it because I had already gotten ahead of where they were. And the teacher, Randy, at that school, Mott Community College in Flint, he just had like this amazing way of doing the program. We each had a hard drive. We put our name on it. And in the front of the computer tower was a removable drive bay. So the big hard drive, you just slide your hard drive in and boot it. And the idea was you have to maintain that installation throughout the class. That's your installation. It belongs to only you, and each of you get your own. And I thought that was a fantastic way to do it. And I learned so much in that class. And then from there, it just kind of spiraled. I had Windows XP at the time, which was, what everything came with. And, I still didn't get my foot in the door in IT yet, so I didn't have a lot of money, didn't have an internet connection all the time. So when Windows XP came up for activation, because I reinstalled it and you had to activate it, I remember, I mentioned this in the last one, I'll keep this short, but had to go to the payphone with an activation code written on a piece of paper and then take that back and do the activation, which worked just fine. In Microsoft's defense, I was able to activate it, but I was also thinking, why am I standing at a payphone in November in Michigan, where the chill is just going through my bones, asking Microsoft for permission to use the computer that I bought with my hard-earned money? I just didn't think that was okay. A lot of people don't care; they just do what they have to do. But for me, it was more of a moral issue. It's like, my opinion is that unless you exercise a warranty, your relationship with the vendor should be over at the point of purchase and never continue until, hey, I have a warranty claim, or if you have a support contract, then you can call it. But for a company to continue to have leverage after you buy something on whether or not you can use it, that just didn't make sense to me. So meanwhile, shortly after that, finally got my foot in the door in IT, and I was just working my way up, started in help desk. And I had all these coincidental issues with working in corporate America. The first IT job I had, like 3 months later, they said, okay, we're going to start a round of layoffs. I'm like, really? I just started this job. Oh my God. So that was a lot of stress. I had a company that just set us down. This was years later, and says, sorry, this is 3 weeks' notice. The company's closing our doors, and we all need to look for a new job because corporate decided to cut off the office that we work in. So I kept having all these, coincidental issues with corporate America, which, nothing against anyone's job. I'm sure a lot of people out there have, worked for someone else and they have a great time. But for me, it was just like I was always at someone else's mercy. So I always, at that point, I knew I wanted to be in business for myself and I'd work toward that. I didn't know what then to do because at first I thought, oh, computer repair, I could fix computers. And I did that for a while and people loved my services. And I figured out problems, as I call them, X files that no one else could figure out. I figured them out, and often cheaper than the competition, so people loved it. But there's not a lot of money in residential computer repair. It's even worse nowadays. People just, practically replace their computer at the shortest sight of a problem, which I don't think is a good thing. But I knew that wasn't something that was sustainable. And then eventually I decided to go back to college. And when I went back to college, I had to take some Java classes, which I didn't really enjoy. I love programming, just not a fan of Java for reasons I won't get into. And I struggled. I just couldn't, I never wanted to learn Java. I had to learn it. So I read the book. I just couldn't get through it. The book was dry and boring, in my opinion. So I found some YouTube tutorials by complete accident where someone was just going over Java, and for some reason it clicked. Like watching these videos one by one, I was able to pass that class with a B, and otherwise I don't think I would have got through it because I have also have ADHD. So if I really don't want to learn something, it's harder to learn it. But this really helped out, and later on I thought, well, I've been studying Linux for years at this point. Maybe I should just do a few tutorials and see what happens. So I went to the flea market. I bought a $150 cheap, abused laptop that was sitting on the shelf. Went to Walmart, bought a $15 microphone, and that's what I started with. And the quality was absolutely terrible. I didn't even know how to edit video, but I put out some tutorials and people seemed to like it. And at first it was, the pay is really low. I might get $70 every other month. So I would call it my PlayStation 3 money. Every other month, I can get a PlayStation 3 game because that's about how much it was. And then later on, and this is, fast forward about 5 or 6 years, I was just doing YouTube as a hobby. I just had this anxiety take over, a good kind of anxiety, but it was overwhelming that this inner voice is like, you got to do something with this now. Like now's the time, make it a thing. Figure out how you want to do it and make it a bigger production. So starting at that point, I decided, okay, I'm going to really try to make this my own job and my only thing. I need to get the quality up. I need to get the narrative level up. I have all these different things that I have to approve to get it closer to my vision. I began working on that. And then, roughly 2 or 3 years later, I was able to quit my day job. And then I finally felt like I had this freedom because when you have all these, this bad luck working for other people, I think it's kind of natural to say, you know, I don't want my fate to be up to whether another company exists or not, or what, or layoffs or what have you. I want to be in control of my own fate. It was important to me. And since the YouTube thing was going very well, decided to push that. And then it kind of became an education company. And I say that because it's not the YouTube channel is the most popular thing that I do, but there's also books, there's going to be cheat sheets, and I write articles from time to time. So there's like this umbrella, and even video courses outside of YouTube. So it ends up being more of an education company, although, you know, again, YouTube is going to be the thing that most people know me from. And one of the things about that I thought was interesting is that I always wanted to, at least as a side job, be a college instructor. I thought that would be a lot of fun. But recently it dawned on me like, well, yeah, that's great and all, but I'm teaching people all over the world already, which is an incredible realization, although it's obvious. But it was just like, well, you know, maybe I'm already living my dream. And that's when I realized, you know, in regard to teaching on the side, I'm already teaching globally. So I think I checked that box. And from there, I just kind of became obsessed with the quality of the writing and the videos because, and when I write a script, which I started, I think maybe 2 years ago, I decided I'm going to write every script for every video instead of just talk off the top of my head like I used to do. Come up with a narrative since I've been writing since I was seven, which is another story in and of itself. I've always loved writing. I put that energy into the narrative to make sure that it's cohesive from beginning to end. I'm meeting them where they are at the beginning, where someone may not know much about it, and then kind of step by step taking them through it, but making it fun because the two problems I have with education, one is I don't feel like IT programs generally prepare students the right way, and also it's often boring. So I just sometimes, you know, decide to jazz it up a bit. Like I do a video about the cat command, but I put real cats in it, you know, just something nobody expects. And it's kind of like that moment where it's like, I don't know why he's doing this, but it's getting my attention. So I think that holding someone's attention, telling a story, which I don't know if people would really notice this about my videos, but in every video I tell a story. And then meanwhile, and this brings us to the book. Not everyone wants to learn by watching videos. It's just the way it is. Some people want to learn by reading. Some people want to learn by watching videos. Some people can learn either way. So I wanted to make sure that I also had something for those people. So I had a publishing contract. I believe it started in 2014. And not to throw anyone under the bus, this the situation with the publisher wasn't great, and had some contractual risks involved in that. So it just didn't really seem like it was, you know, conducive to write for a publisher. I want, you know, again, we go back to I want my own to be in control of my own fate. With a publisher, it's like, I want to do a book about this. No, how about you do this instead? It's like, how about I do neither? And I'll just write on my own. But I wanted to try the self-publishing thing. And at first, it kind of seemed like, well, that's a lot to learn, and I got all these videos to do. So it took me a little while to, you know, come to terms with the system, and not really that long, but it's just, you know, being busy. But then once I found LeanPub, it's like, oh, I can write the book in Git. I can actually use version control and the tools that I already know, which is one of the things that I like the most. And I also have a friend that also writes, Jeff Geerling, who I know
Oh,
a
yeah.
lot of people, yeah, in my audience know who he is. He's a fantastic, amazing human being, such a joy to talk to. And you know, I just asked him a few things about it. He says it seems like it's going pretty well for him. So all that combined, I decided, okay, you know, I'm going to give this a shot. And I kind of tested the waters by making a quick ebook just to kind of learn the process, and then you know, go right into the main book, Switching to Linux, which was just released. And considering I had a publishing contract, I wanted to start kind of back from the beginning, write something for beginners because it's kind of like a phoenix, right? I'm starting over on my own. I'm going to start at the beginner level and then try to build people up. But the next book will be more advanced because I know the advanced people want something too. So I'm actually working on that right now. But it's kind of exciting. It's still a little unknown, you know, how things are going to go in marketing and sales and all of that. But so far, it's been a breath of fresh air not having to argue with a publisher about every single decision that I make. That's great.
Yeah, well, thanks very much for sharing that really great story from beginning to end. That's kind of the perfect kind of intro to the podcast. There's a number of things I can ask you about. One is so when you got that first job in IT, did you know anybody else who'd worked in the area or had jobs like that? Or was it like a
No.
completely new thing to you? Like when you walked into the office, did you know how to like what an office was like. I'm just asking this kind of based on
Oh
personal
yeah.
experience like that.
So I've been working in business before that. I started in tech support, non-IT. I mean, just generic tech support for a credit card processing company. And I had this knack of just solving problems. I know now why it is because I just love puzzles. I love to figure things out. So I ended up doing really well at that job, but it was a dead end career. It wasn't in IT and it just wasn't for me. But I was actually working my way up into management at that time. I
Okay.
was a team lead, so I was doing pretty well, but I just knew there wasn't a future in it. And still to this day, I don't know how it happened. I was riding the bus to work. And I get this call for an IT job. And mind you, the credit card processor was an hour and a half away. Okay. It was a long ride. But this job just happened to be like 7 minutes down my street. And I cannot, and I don't remember applying to it or anything. It's just all of a sudden that call got onto my phone and I decided to take the job. That's also the one that had layoffs shortly after. But when I got in the door, I generally, yeah, I understood how things were, at least at a beginner perspective, because I was, and how things went. And the Linux experience kind of helped because that gave me some ideas about how servers work in general. But there was still this other side that I didn't yet understand, like network management. I wasn't there yet. There was a network manager on staff. So it was kind of challenging in a way because it's like, you know, you get excited. Oh, this is my foot in the door, and then you hear, oh, we're going to start layoffs. Then it's like you spend the rest of your time at that job just like kind of watching your back, just trying not to make any mistakes to get chosen for said layoffs. And at the I think the third round of layoffs, so there's not one, not two, but three rounds of layoffs, and the third one got me. And you know, from there, I've just been kind of bouncing around trying to find a forever home, so to speak. I've had jobs for multiple years, but it would always end with company is going out of business, company got acquired, which was another one that happened several times. And that just kind of made me just not lose faith in corporate America in general. But for me, it just kind of seemed like, well, the writing's on the wall. I need to be in control of things, I think.
Yeah, no, that totally makes a lot of sense. The next question I have is I'm not exactly sure how to ask it, but so there's a question that comes up because you've partially answered it already, but there's a question that often comes up on this podcast, particularly because the guests, so many of them are, programmers or into that kind of thing, people in technology generally, and there are many, many vintages, sort of the oldest vintage we had was a guy whose first job was being a computer.
Oh boy.
Yeah, and then so all the way up to sort of people who are, sort of relatively young and sort of new programmers and stuff like that. But the question is, and I know from your LinkedIn that you did a sort of like a bachelor's in information technology and you have a master's as well. If you were starting out now with the intention of having a career like you did, would you do a formal university degree?
No. No, I wouldn't. Now, to be fair, I really enjoyed my time at college because I love academia. I love education and learning. So I got a lot of fun out of it and I really enjoyed it. And ever since I finished, I'm like, man, I wish I can go back. But, you know, student loan bills being what they are, that's not a good thing. But when I look at my career, and then also later when I stopped working for other people, I ended my career as director of IT operations for the entire company. So I literally worked my way to the very top of my field. But at the same time, I don't know that my education got me there, because one of the things that I think a lot of people don't talk about is, or ask about is, okay, I got this job. I got chosen for the job, and that's great. I got an offer. That's pretty cool. Then they work there, and life is good. But does anyone really ask, like, their hiring manager, by the way, was it the degree? Did that help? Or, I mean, would
Right.
the hiring manager even reveal the decision-making process in the first place? Because, everyone's afraid of litigation these days. But I never really knew that that helped me get there. And while I was in college, I kind of just felt like it was just below my skill level too often. Like the bachelor's program, I was taking Introduction to Operating Systems, and I just begged to get out of that class. I'm like, this is such a waste of time. I know what an operating system is, but I still had to take it. And what I realized is that a lot of the things that people are expected to know, I think I said this in the last podcast, version control, like Git. Is most people think it's just for developers, but system administrators use it a lot too. But when I looked most recently at some random college programs, that wasn't taught. And I don't even think that was taught in development programs either, which is shocking. On the other hand, I mean, if you're going into something like, the medical field or mental health or something like that, it's a very specific program that you have to be certified or know certain things just to get in a job, and you have to do an internship to prove it. But when it comes to IT, even when I was hiring people, the degree didn't matter to me at all. Like I just didn't even like look at it. And my line of thinking was, your GitHub account is your portfolio, okay? Like whatever you put in there, it doesn't mean you have to be a developer, meaning you could write notes and put your notes in Git, just something like showing that you're learning and the work that you've done. How much are you a part of the community? How much passion do you have about technology, learning new things? Those are the things that really resonate with me. So between, my not using the degree as a factor so much when I hired people, and also not feeling like my own degree prepared me any more than learning by myself prepared me, it just became kind of difficult. I think the main thing about, and I did a video about this, when it comes to hiring managers, because people ask me, is a degree important? Is certifications important? The answer is no. And it's also yes. You don't know what the hiring manager, themselves are looking for. You could be in an interview with someone who champions certifications. You could be in an interview with someone who thinks that certifications are just a piece of paper. They want a degree. You could be with someone that wants neither. They want experience. There's no one thing that all hiring managers are looking for. It really just depends on that person's particular flavor. And at the end of the day, sometimes what gets you through the job is that it's not any one thing, it's the combination of all the things that you have that get you through it. But are you really going to know that it was your degree or your certifications? It's hard to say. And so I think a lot of people just don't know. But to answer your question, no, I think that I would have probably just used that time just to study for more certifications or more advanced technologies would have carried me further than learning Introduction to Operating Systems, in the third or fourth year of college.
Thanks very much for that really great answer. I've had many many versions of an answer like that before from different people. It's interesting. One of the student loans do come up, particularly if the guest I'm talking to is American, although that's a growing issue elsewhere as well. And it really does change. It's the student loans that people often come out are so high now that it really does mean you have to ask some very serious questions about what you're going to be doing with your life for the next 20 years after you finish, basically. And in particular, like I've heard, people who are like bored in college, stuff like that, that often kind of influences it. There are people, they say, I mean, the best answers are always like, should you get one? Is it valuable? Yes and no. For example, there are certain kinds of industries like defense, for example, I think, where actually having a degree might just be a requirement. Like they might just not be a big defense company for certain roles. They might just not be allowed to hire someone who doesn't have a university degree in that area. And if that sounds silly to someone, if some of the more kind of like, radical people listening, it's kind of like if something goes wrong and someone goes, you hired somebody, so you hired who did it go wrong under? And then there's a certain kind of person who, if they ask you, but you hired someone who didn't even have a degree, that they don't want to hear that answer ever. So there's all kinds of, but there's, as you say, like it matters who you're talking to, what their experience is, what they're hiring for. I mean, I've had lots of quite a few guests say that, yeah, like, a degree never meant anything to me at all in hiring. And other people who would say things basically along the lines of, but if I'm picking between two people, having a degree and not having a degree might, might stand one person in better stead. And on the other hand, it might go the other way. It might be like this person's just as good as the other one, but they didn't have to go to university to get the degree, or to get to the level of skill and experience that they have. So it can. So the unsatisfying answer to anyone listening who's like thinking about should I get a university degree for, if I'm going into like technology is like there's no one answer.
And another thing that plays into this too, you could very like let's say you have no degree, and you, luckily, the hiring manager, you won't know it ahead of time, but they don't care about that at all. But maybe the receptionist does, for example, he or she is filtering all the resumes that don't have a degree, even though the hiring manager doesn't care if you have one or not. It's possible that you might not get that interview just by account of the filtering at the very beginning, because all the resumes come in. There's usually somebody that is filing them in this folder or that folder before sending them on to a hiring person to make the initial phone call. So sometimes, and people get discouraged. I didn't get a call. I didn't get a job there. Well, it's not personal. You literally could be the victim of a filter at
Well,
the end of
and those
the
filters can
day.
be automated, and they can be much more specific, I think, than people might think. And so, for example, like it could be that just some filter says like if the name of an Ivy League university is in your application, then you're just like top of the pile, and that just might be the case for that process. I remember back when I was applying for investment banking jobs years ago. I'm Canadian, and I remember there was when I started like looking at the application process for American investment banks, like the big ones that you've all heard of. Some of the application forms had lists of specific East Coast prep schools for high school. Did you go to this school? And it's kind of like, boy, do you, is there a kind of big shock of cold water about like, what kind of ceilings do I face if I'm just, some, nobody from Saskatchewan or something like that, when you start seeing that, oh, like the certain kinds of filtering already start happening in certain socioeroconomic networks long before you have any choice about what's happening.
Yeah, I agree about the frustration of not being able to get a straight answer. But unfortunately, that's the truth. It's kind of like just a chess game. At the end of the day, you're just trying to play the best moves that you can to get where you want to be, and just keep playing until you win.
So, moving on to the next part of the interview where we talk about the book. In this case, we've actually already kind of talked about the book at length in a launch video. And so I wanted to sort of take the opportunity to now to talk about the why to switch to Linux question. And so, for example, you talked about, companies trying to retain control of your thing that you've bought after you've bought it. And this goes all the way from, like tractors to
Oh, yeah, John
computers.
Deere. Yeah, John
Yeah, the
Deere.
John Deere, so that's a very, I just wanted to ask you about that, just generally about that question. What's your sort of take on the current state of affairs? Do you think it's getting worse or better when it comes to kind of buyer control of things? Because the headlines that if you follow that kind of stuff, the headlines seem to go one way one month and the other way another month.
I think it's more of a roller coaster because, sometimes I wonder when a company makes a really stupid decision, it's like, were they really thinking about this? Like, I'm trying to remember the name of that Microsoft technology that was very controversial lately, where it's kind of taking a screenshot of everything that you're doing. And they think that this is a great thing because, if you forget what you were doing or need a visual reminder of what you were doing that day, which, to be fair, could be useful for people, but it was just like, in my opinion, it's like that does not stand up to scrutiny. Sure, that could be something that people would enjoy, but who's keeping that information? How secure is it? Where is it going? How is it being transmitted? And if threat actor breaks into your system and gets a hold of that data that's stored locally, then would they be able to, access it? Would it be encrypted at rest? Would it not be? All these usual questions. And, given big tech companies, even if they did all of that right, there's still going to be scrutiny and people that are calling foul. So often, companies, say, hey, we're going to change the way you use your computer. It's like, what? Why? And then this is the same company that at one point Microsoft had an upgrade to, I think it was Windows 10, where it had yes or no or something like that, and re regardless of which one you clicked was yes, it literally started the upgrade and it tricked you into this. And it just seems like companies are trying and trying to control the way that people use their device. And the way I look at it, obviously many of the people listening to the podcast and my audience, we love technology, so we can't imagine not loving it. But if we think of, everybody else, which is like the majority of the population, right? The people that are the consumers of it, they see a computer as an appliance. To them, it's like buying a microwave, a refrigerator, or a stove. They look at the features. Is it going to do the thing that I need to do? Great. Okay, I'll buy it. And they think that, in their mind, it's an appliance. They don't care. They're not like technology fans, but they know they need a computer for some things, so they're just going to get one. And then the companies just continue to have control over that, and I don't really like that. So, for example, I remember back in the day, I would, I'm aging myself, but I would go to the checkout lanes, and there's these AOL CDs there that say, you get a certain amount of time on the internet for a certain amount of money, and then, later on, internet was just unlimited everywhere. Just use whatever you want. And at some point, we kind of de-evolve, and companies are putting bandwidth limits in again and are throttling connections. And that's one problem with ISPs I won't go down a rabbit hole on. But then when you have the operating systems are downloading updates you didn't ask for, they're downloading apps like Bejeweled and putting it on your start menu, you didn't ask for that. You have ads in your browser. All these things are consuming data that you're paying for, right? It's going coming out of your bandwidth. It's counting against you, and you didn't even ask for it. And meanwhile, your CPU is running CPU cycles to process these ads and things that you didn't ask for. So now your CPU is not just working for you. It's not just seeing an ad on a screen or downloading something, to your computer you didn't ask for. That's consuming resources, hard drive, memory, CPU. And sure, it's such a negligible amount that, you're unlikely to notice that any of this is going on. But to be fair, your computer's not working directly for you, right? Imagine you go to your microwave and you put in a bag of popcorn. It says, "Error, error. You eat too much popcorn. Must try healthy food," or something. Like, what? Like, why does it have so much control over what I do? And then, on the Apple side of things, it's like if you don't sign up for Apple Pay, you'll be asked every single OS upgrade for setting up Apple Pay, and you don't get an option that says, "Don't remind me again." It's either yes or later. You don't have a no option. It's your computer, but you don't have a way to say no. You can only say, "I'll do it later," even though you won't, if you don't intend to. So, and that's on top of these popover ads and all these things that are showing, click jacking and ads and all these different things that happen. It just becomes this, situation where the company is not only controlling what your resources are being used for. I mean, you could have an Android phone that's only supported for a year after you buy it. You could have a PC that only gets a couple years of updates because the, vendor doesn't want to support it longer than that. So there's just, I mean, imagine if your refrigerator had an end of life date on it. Your fridge is going to expire in 2 years. What? Usually people use their fridge until it breaks, right? So it's like all these different things. And I think it's interesting that in some ways, I think people have given up. I mean, normally I would say, just let the companies know this is not okay. And enough people do it. And backlash works because we've seen companies backtrack on situations like just hit the news recently. I think this week, it's not IT related, but it's parallel, that Sony is going to be ending physical discs for games as of, I think, 2028. And to me, that's an example of a decision that industry-wide is not going to be accepted, and they'll probably backpedal on it due to backlash if there's enough of it. And then they'll pull that back and say, "Okay, fine, we'll keep doing it." And I think, getting back to technology and operating systems, that's kind of what we have to do. And I mean, in regard to Apple, for example, their most recent OS, just I don't personally care, but some people are very specific. The edges aren't rounded in the right way, they're not consistent. The glass effect is different depending on what app you use, and it's a very inconsistent OS. And people just constantly just say, "Hey, fix it, please." And in their defense, they are on the next release, but at the same time, they weren't really listening to feedback. So sometimes you get into a situation where, the companies think they know better than you, but no one knows your workflow better than you do, right? So you know what you use your computer for and what's important to you. And when it comes to, an alternative operating system like Linux, then, there's multiple distributions. So if you try one, maybe you don't like it, that's totally fine. You can try another one, and maybe the third one will resonate with you, but there's different versions and flavors and whatnot. So you get this endless customization. You get full control over what to turn off or what not to. Or if you don't really care, you could just do none of that and just use a, something like Ubuntu or Fedora as is probably good enough for most people. Even if you don't want to tweak things, you don't have to. But if you do want to remove something, then you can. And I think that flexibility is really important. And it's not to say that this kind of thing doesn't happen in the Linux world. Some time ago, Canonical, the makers of Ubuntu, got under fire for putting ads in the launcher quite a while ago. But it didn't last long because the Linux community, if something like that goes on, because we love the freedom, we love the customizability that we have here, and if anything threatens that, we really let people know. And Ubuntu is not doing that anymore.
Well, and I think that's a great answer to the question. I mean, why switch to Linux, right? Not only is the operating system, does it work a certain way? Is it open source, et cetera? But there's a whole community of people out there who are the reason it exists, and they have principles. And like, not everyone's going to be always in agreement with each other, obviously, and they might seriously disagree. But there is a general kind of reason that people are there using it, typically, and contributing to the community and stuff like that. It's just, I find this question fascinating. I mean, so for example, just like, because in the end, it's a philosophical question about how you want to live, right? And so, for example, if I, and when I, like, you talked about controversies, Apple had one a few years ago where they just pushed the new YouTube album into everybody's iTunes,
Oh,
if you
right,
recall that
U2.
one.
It was U2 that
You,
on the
sorry,
iPhone.
sorry, you,
It
did
was
I, I said,
the
yeah, YouTube,
iPod. Yeah. There's literally a removal tool that they created for that. I remember that. That
yeah,
was
and
interesting.
it's like, the thing is, when you said the companies think they know better than you, it's kind of like there's something when you understand the mindset that the people had who made that decision. What a delight. Wouldn't it be such a delight? A free album by U2, the great U2, in my, just be free. I mean, who could be against that? And that's what I mean by, like, if you're making a philosophical choice about how you want to live, right? Do you want people relating to you that way, in that kind of top down, completely presumptuous, basically kind of chauvinistic way?
I
Like,
agree.
you
And
know.
the thing, one thing I'll add to that really quick is that I don't understand this, but I mean, these tech companies are brilliant, but there's one obvious thing that none of them seem to get, and that is all people are oppositionally defiant to a point. Now, I'm not talking about the oppositional defiant disorder thing, which some people have, but I think everybody is defiant to a point because we have, and they're called boundaries. There's things that we're okay with, and there's things that we're not okay with. But more often than not, you could tell somebody, "I need you to do this." They might not be so keen to do it unless it's something they want to do. So if someone says, "You can have this U2 album if you want it, click here," a lot of people would. But if you say, "You're getting it," then people says, "Oh, I am? What? I didn't have a say in this." Even if they like U2, right? They might think it's the best band on the planet, but the fact that it's being forced on them just creates this anxiety. And if companies realize that, this is almost universally true to a point, that maybe they would make better decisions if they kept that in mind.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And there is something too about how that reminds me of one, like, one of my complaints would be, like, often the decisions seem to be made by people for whom nothing negative can really touch them. So, for example, I remember, like, I'm going to complain about, I won't name it, but there's a payment service a few years ago that added circle faces to, like, when you went to go pay, like a person's profile circle face. Do you want to pay this person? Do you want to pay that person? And it's like, anybody can upload any picture of a circle face. I'm paying it an email address. And if to me, sending $50 to the wrong person means it didn't go to my grandma and now she can't get the bus ticket to come visit for Christmas, you would never design something like that ever in a million years. Another example that I always like, my personal hobby horse is that Gmail, I will name them, hides the email address that you're sending it to and replaces it with the name that the person put in. Anybody can put any name in that they want. You're not sending an email to a name. You're sending an email to an email address. And if you've ever, like had a job, like, my mind was not romantic, but it was investment banking. If you ever have a job where you can go to jail for sending an email to the wrong person because you're disclosing information or something like that, or where it's just, it would hurt someone to send that email to the wrong, you don't want any of the, you don't want a delightful experience. You want to know exactly what's going on. And if you've ever worked in anything time sensitive, where there would actually be real consequences that would matter to you, you don't want to turn on your computer and have it be different. My brother's analogy to, you've used a couple of examples kind of like this before, is like, how in adventure games, there's a little puzzle to solve if you want to open the door. Imagine you went to open your, you've got like all your groceries piled up and your kid, and maybe your car keys. And then you kind of had to like, you went to open your door handle and the door handle was a different shape. You'd be like, well, now I can't get into my house, and then all the house of cards comes tumbling down. And like, and I get the impression, it seems to me that there's a cultural thing going on, specific partly behind what the why the big companies get those things wrong, is that it basically, if you've come from a background or you've been in a life so long where basically you're rich, you don't, and this is not like I would like to be rich, like I'm not condemning wealth or anything like that, but like if you really lived a kind of consequence-free consciousness in a certain way, then you're going to make design decisions like this. Life is going to be, the products you design are going to be about, oh, what a delightful surprise, because if things, if little things go wrong, they don't matter to you.
I think at the center of a lot of this is that people more often than not hate change, which is weird for anyone in my field to say that because we love change because we get new applications, we get new distributions, and we love new technologies that are coming out. But I feel it's safe to say the majority of people in general don't like change. They like to, there's a certain way they're doing things. They want to do those things the same way every time. And too often, to your point, things are just being changed where it's like the carpet is being pulled right out from under them. But that also means that people are less likely to switch to anything else. Like people ask me why hasn't the Linux desktop became number one? And then they'll come out with all these graphs and all these reasons, and they put out all these articles about this, and everyone just has all these, big opinions about it. And I can just summarize, the truth and say people hate change, right? It's not, I mean, sure, it's not that those things that people say aren't true. Someone might say Linux isn't the number one because there's no AAA games or as many AAA games available for it. But keep in mind, not everybody's a gamer, right? So that's not really a factor for everybody. It is a big factor for some people, but not for everybody. But at the center of it is people hate change. So someone, could have the mentality, oh, Windows downloaded a new game, and I didn't ask for it, or Apple's trying to get me to sign up for something, and they just habitually say no, thank you over and over again, and find workarounds, find the U2 album removal tool for their iPhone or iPod, as they did then, and they do that because I think change is anxiety invoking more so. Like it's one thing to go through, oh great, I have this thing I got to fix again, but tell somebody, oh, I'm going to like change everything on your computer, and you have to learn everything from top to bottom. So in my opinion, it's not really a testament to how good or bad Linux is, but the human nature is like, we think of change and we think of, oh man, it just some we get feelings from that. We get this dread because it's like, oh, I gotta learn a new operating system, then that must mean that I'm going to be later turning in my assignments at work because it's going to take me longer to do the same things that I was doing on the previous one. And I think that's at a big part of it. So I think companies, it's almost like it's not forced lock-in because, it is and it's not. No, Microsoft isn't forcing you to keep Windows on your computer. I mean, there have been some attempts, but I won't get into that. But more generally speaking, you can remove Windows and put Linux on it. They're not going to come to your house and knock on your door and say, shame on you. But so if anybody can do it, then why don't they? And then again, come back to, change is hard. And I think most people really don't like that. And when it comes to technologists like myself, we don't even think about that because from our mindset, change is awesome. That's a new feature, a new app. We love it. But the average person, if they could keep using Windows XP, chances are they probably would be still using it.
Yeah, I mean that reminds me of a version of that we've had at LeanPub over the years is like ditch Microsoft Word, write in Markdown. You know, it's actually simpler and easier. And like as soon as no way walls shields up. You know, there's no getting through. And I don't say that as a criticism of anybody who wants to stick with the tool that they know and are accustomed to it. There's lots of reasons to want to stick to it, but yeah, from the technologist side, it can often be kind of frustrating. And then, you know, to put myself being maybe kind of guilty party in the sort of story I was telling too, you know, for people from my kind of mindset, you know, I sort of like would probably be more inclined to create a feature that would push someone towards something that I just technically know is better, rather than leave them with something that I think is technically worse, but they're more comfortable with and know how to use.
And I think I find, or I found when I was working for other companies, when we would change to open source software and someone gets upset, LibreOffice came to mind. I don't feel that we're in IT always good communicators. I mean, we are, but sometimes there's like this empathy that we need to have because we're kind of on guard, right? Someone comes up to our desk, something's down, like, oh no, we got to fix the thing. But you got to put yourself where someone else is and just be transparent. Like it might be a little different. I mean, you could say it's free, it's open source, it's great, and they're like, what? But what you could say is, you know, the company behind, you know, Microsoft Word has a history of, you know, legal tactics and shenanigans that put our company at risk of potential licensing lawsuits and things that would limit our ability to not only grow or hire more people, but to protect the interests of the company and also make sure that we all have a place to work. We need to kind of disconnect some of these things from the companies that are potentially going to cause us financial harm. It's about the freedom to just keep the company doing what we do without having, you know, leashes on us, so to speak. And sometimes if you just put it that way, then they get it. It's like, okay, yeah, okay, this software might not be the same thing. And he's not saying that I'm not supposed to feel, you know, challenged by this. He's acknowledging, hey, this is hard. I know it's hard. But at the same time, you're just letting them know the global truth of things. It's like, this is the situation out there in the world, and we're just protecting our interests so we can keep us working every day. I think that doesn't always work, but sometimes if you're just transparent with people, it could go a lot further than how some IT people do it, which is like, yeah, we're doing a new thing. Oh, you don't want the new thing? Well, you're getting the new thing. It's a policy, which is what I hear a lot. And yeah, then resentment happens.
Yeah, definitely. Just moving on to the last part of the interview, where we talked about your experience as a writer and, you know, in this case, kind of video content creator. You talked a little bit about your experience writing and you know, enjoying writing and telling stories, and teaching and stuff like that. So I guess my question would be, for you right now, so for someone who's interested, let's say, in being as productive as you are and making videos as popular as yours are on YouTube, do you have a kind of like daily routine that you go through?
Yeah, I have so many. Everything that I do, I think of it kind of like an assembly line. I find that when you have all these different things, like people will ask, like, how do you keep track of all this? You're doing courses, you're doing YouTube videos, you're doing ebooks, you're doing books, and then you're doing podcasts, and still you're keeping up to date on what's going on in the industry. Like, do you sleep? But when you look at it strategically, I'm not doing all those things at the same time every day. Sometimes it's just a matter of, you know, which thing am I going to tackle today? Maybe it could be write a chapter of the book. I need to get that done by the end of the day. Or it could be I have to write five scripts for a video, so I'll get that done. It's kind of compartmentalizing things, but in terms of like producing content, it's like an assembly line and two examples of that. So when it comes to a video, it follows the same process every time. I have a list of potential ideas that are usually like 30, 40 ideas thick that may or may not be a video. Then I have another bucket, which is confirmed topics. So I could take it out of this bucket, put it in the confirmed. Like I know I'm doing this video, I'll put it over here. I'm definitely doing that one. And that just becomes like a set. And then what I'll do is I'll just spend an entire day writing the treatment for every video that I chose. So I could have chose five videos. So in the morning, I'm going to start on the first one. I'm going to write the script for all five. And now I have a stack of five scripts sitting on my desk. And maybe I have to change hats, the next day and fix my servers or do whatever I need to do. But then at some point, it comes time to film it, whatever day I chose. So I just, open the script. Sometimes I'm literally just reading it into the microphone, and there's like nothing video-wise being recorded. And then I'll go back and add the video parts later. I think I might have used this as joke B-roll, where I'm just reading a script like this. But anyway, I read the script, and maybe another day is the B-roll day. I got to record all the B-roll that I wrote down, so I'll do all that. And then once I assemble that, it goes into the editing queue. And from there, it goes down to pipeline. Now, for a book, it could be, I have a template, for example, that I create for myself. It could be like an outline template, which just has the headings for the chapters, empty headings, obviously, but it's got maybe it has like 10 chapter files that are empty with just markdown samples in there, in each one. So all I have to do is, write the content, but then I do the outline. On a piece of paper or something. And when I decide that, then I make a copy of the template folder, and now it's a book. And okay, it's going to have 20 chapters, so I need to have 20 templates. And I just copy the headings and the outline in each chapter. And now the chapters are just, structurally done, no content, but there's all the headings where they need to be. And then in between other things, I just go in and just keep filling out different things in those outlines until it becomes a full book. If it's a course, like a video course, it follows the same thing: write the script, record, edit. It's even down to where I have all of the assets I use for video production, like the intros, the lower thirds, the animated backgrounds. It's all a template. They're all pre-rendered at the right resolution and the frame rate ahead of time. So I drop it in and I just go through it. From left to right until it's done. So it's kind of keeps things exciting because, maybe Monday is writing day or Tuesday is script writing day, and Wednesday I'm filming, and then I have to spend 2 or 3 days editing. So it kind of just becomes this strategy. But also, the order in which you do things matters too. So, for example, if I needed to do an installation video of Ubuntu and perhaps an installation video of Fedora, but I also need to review them because a new release came out. What I'm absolutely not going to do is record the install Ubuntu video, erase it, record the install Fedora video, erase it, then reinstall Ubuntu, review it, then go to Fedora, review it. It logically, if you're going to install Fedora, record it. And since it's installed, I may as well do the review. I mean, what would be the point of tearing it down to do a different video at that point? I'd save a ton of time since I already have it set up. I could do both in one day. So now I have both. And if I, while I have Fedora installed, for example, I might look at my list and say, well, I have three videos on this list that are all Fedora related. So I'll record each of those since I already have it set up. And then I find the content starts to stack because I'm more strategically, like the order I do it in is important. Or if maybe I didn't get enough sleep, I'll just choose the easy projects for a particular day to take it easy. And I think when you have, a structure to it, and for me it took years, it makes it really easy to just keep producing. But it also means you're not going to get burned out as much, because if you're doing the same thing every single day, that sucks. But for me, it's like system administration day. Today I'm doing Ansible, and then another day I'm doing this, and then I'm doing that. So every day I'm wearing a different hat, but I always keep track of where all the projects are, so I know what the missing pieces are. And I think once you get that magic formula or system in place, and it could take many years to get to this point. I want to be clear, you're not going to do this quick. Just keep working at it. And eventually, I think you'll find the shortest path of least resistance for yourself.
Thanks for that really great explanation. I mean, there's so much, wisdom and hard-earned, knowledge in there. In particular, the idea, like, I mean, not everybody would make the point that you did twice, that it's going to take you a long time to get fast.
Right.
But this is just a key feature of it. And one thing I would say, just from my own experience, is that you've got to, one feature of this, you've got to be always trying to improve. And that is no matter how good you get. Or how fast you get, or you've got to always be trying to improve. But the template thing that you mentioned, starting from a template that is, refined over time
Yep.
is a great key to kind of regularity, avoiding mistakes, avoiding forgetting loose ends, all that kind of stuff. Like that, the templates are a really great way of not only speeding things up, but improving the quality of the things that you do over time. And it's not a matter of making it boring and regular and the same every time. It's a matter of freeing you up to be more creative because
Oh,
you're
yeah.
spending less time on process. And that's maybe one of the secrets about it, about being, so good at it after all that time getting fast.
Oh, yeah. I have absolutely agree because I find more time to focus on the writing and what I want to write about. I could come up with more fun ideas. Like I randomly come up with the last distro standing challenge for choosing a distro, which is also kind of based loosely on something I talk about in the book, but it's just like, oh, here's an idea. I could be more creative. So absolutely, just less time on drudgery means more time on fun.
The last question that I always like to ask on the podcast, if the guest is a Lean Pub author, is if there was any magical feature we could build for you that you could ask us to build for you, or if there was one thing that you absolutely hate about Lean Pub that has you shaking your fist, yelling at the screen when you're using Lean Pub that you could ask us to fix for you, can you think of anything that you would ask us to do?
Oh gosh, not as of yet. At some point, I'm writing the book in the terminal basically, and it
Right.
goes in, and I don't have to spend as much time. I was interested in the back cover not being there, but I know it's an ebook, so it kind of really doesn't matter. So there was that. I'm not really sure I could think of a whole lot. That's a tough question. I didn't run into anything. I think what I ran into was just learning the syntax of the markdown language the way that it's supposed to be, and the trial and error. One thing I did notice now that I think about it, which doesn't really matter to me, is whenever I'm generating a book, it's like if I have already generated a version of it earlier, then no progress bar shows up on the top until I go all the way out to the main page and then manually click through back to it, and then it starts to show up. But I don't really know if that's a browser issue or actually a
Okay,
problem with
okay.
LeanPub. But yeah, no, I think it's fantastic. I love the fact that you could use Git and in those tools. I don't have any experience with any other method of writing for LeanPub. One suggestion might be to maybe work with GitLab. I think it's GitHub specific, right? Because that's what I put mine in. Mainly other Git tools or other like GitLab or Git might be worth supporting, since a lot of people like to self-host things nowadays, so they could be using more of a self-hosted type of solution. So I would say that could be something too.
Yeah, thanks very much for that suggestion. I mean, it's so funny. Progress bars are just kind of finicky, it appears. But we do try to get those details right, of course. And yeah, we have had requests for sort of GitLab in the past, and I'll just, sort of add your vote to that pile. Jay, thank you very much for taking the time to do this podcast episode with me today. The book is Switching to Linux. And the YouTube channel is Learn Linux TV. If you want to learn more about the book and more specifically, we've got a pretty extensive launch video, as I mentioned before, where you can learn all about the book and what it's about and what you're going to learn in it and everything like that. So thank you very much, Jay, for taking the time to do this podcast interview with me today.
Thanks for having me.